Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Wendy Urquhart, and in the early hours of Friday, the 14th of July, these are our main stories. Tens of thousands of Hollywood actors have been called out on strike after talks over pay and the use of artificial intelligence broke down. President Biden tells a summit in Finland that Vladimir Putin has already lost the war in Ukraine. And for the first time, women in America will soon be able to buy the contraceptive pill without a doctor's prescription. Also in this podcast, the UN says ending the HIV pandemic is still achievable by 2030, but warns underfunding and stigmatization is harming efforts. And why a Canadian zoo is restricting mobile phone viewing for its gorillas.
We don't know exactly how they perceive that content. So we just want to make sure that the things that they're seeing are things that we think are acceptable.
Hollywood actors are going on strike over pay and the use of AI in the industry, leaving hundreds of productions in limbo. Hollywood writers walked out weeks ago, and now that members of the SAG-AFTRA union have joined them, it will bring the entire industry to its knees. The actor, comedian and president of the Screen Actors Guild, Fran Drescher, is fuming.
The entire business model has been changed by streaming, digital, AI. If we don't stand tall right now, we are all going to be in jeopardy of being replaced by machines. We are being victimized by a very greedy entity. I am shocked by the way the people that we have been in business with are treating us. I cannot believe it. How they plead that they're losing money left and right when giving hundreds of millions of dollars to their CEOs. It is disgusting. Shame on them.
Well, our LA reporter Sophie Long is covering the story for us.
Yeah, well, you were right to say that Fran Drescher was fuming. I'm just outside SAG-AFTRA headquarters at the moment, and in a news conference she gave there, it was much more like a rousing speech. And, yeah, she said that this is an existential fight. And so the stakes are high, but so will the impact be as well. When the writers walked out more than 2 months ago, they brought a halt to many productions. When the actors joined them, SAG-AFTRA has 160,000 members, which basically includes almost every film, television and radio actor across the country. So they will bring a halt basically to the whole industry, and the impact of that will be enormous. It'll cost the Californian economy tens of millions of dollars every day. And when, of course, production stops, it's not just the writers and the actors that stop working, it's directors, camera operators and many thousands of people working in adjacent industries, many of them still recovering from the pandemic.
Well, as you say, the companies are already hemorrhaging millions of dollars, and it's about to get even worse. Do we have any idea what the sticking point is for this deal?
Yeah, I think when you hear from people like Fran Drescher, there are many sticking points. One of them is pay and compensation, residual payments. They say have gone down fundamentally over recent years since the whole industry was changed, revolutionized by the streaming revolution. They want greater royalties, basically. They also want an increase in pay to match inflation. And, of course, there's AI, artificial intelligence. Actors are very concerned. They want safeguarding parts in their contracts around AI to prevent their likenesses being used going forward without their permission and without them getting payment for it. So those are the main issues. Now, SAG-AFTRA negotiators say that the studios didn't engage meaningfully on those core issues. The organization representing the studios, though, has said that SAG-AFTRA is walking away from what they called their historic offer on pay and a groundbreaking proposal, they said, that would protect actors from the emergence of AI. Fran Drescher said that the only historic thing about the studio's offer was how disrespectful and how disgusting it was. So after many weeks of negotiations and assistance from a federal mediator at the 11th hour last night, the deadline has passed. SAG-AFTRA have voted again. Strike action will now take place. and 160,000 members of the Actors Union will join 11,000 writers who've been picketing for 6 weeks.
Sophie Long talking to me from Los Angeles. After a four-day trip to Europe, which included the NATO summit in Lithuania and renewed commitment to Ukraine, President Biden has ended his visit with a message for Vladimir Putin. He said Russia can't possibly win the war in Ukraine.
Putin has a real problem. How does he move from here? What does he do? He could end the war tomorrow. He could just say, I'm out. But what agreement is ultimately reached depends upon Putin and what he decides to do. But there is no possibility of him winning the war in Ukraine. He's already lost that war.
Well, our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, gave us his assessment of President Biden's comments.
The war in Ukraine loomed large over what was otherwise a fairly sedate end to Joe Biden's trip to Europe, a summit with Nordic allies. At a news conference, Mr. Biden expressed the hope and expectation that Ukraine would make enough progress in its current counteroffensive for there to be a negotiated settlement at some point. For now, that's a distant prospect. Some 6 weeks in, Ukraine has made relatively limited advances. Mr. Biden also downplayed the chances of Mr. Putin using nuclear weapons, something that only last month he said was a real threat. The West, China and others, he said, had told Russia, don't go there. Coming on the back of a NATO summit in Lithuania, Mr. Biden's trip to Helsinki was a symbolic way of marking Finland's recent accession to the alliance, as well as welcoming the expected accession of Sweden later this year.
Danny Eberhard. Well, for the first time ever, Americans will soon be able to buy birth control pills without a doctor's prescription. Opill, which has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, is likely to be a game changer for many women when it goes on sale early next year. I asked our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley, what difference it will make to women.
It will make a massive difference to millions of women who may have had barriers in transportation and expensive physician fees. And not everybody, of course, has very comprehensive healthcare coverage in the United States. So this opens up the ability of convenience to go into pharmacies, supermarkets and online and buy this daily oral contraceptive pill. It's particularly relevant at the moment where women's reproductive rights has proven to be as controversial as ever, but obviously a controversial US Supreme Court decision last year overturning a previous decision from 1973, coincidentally roughly the same time the Opill has been available for contraceptive purposes under prescription. So this really is a game changer for millions.
Has there been any opposition to the fact that this is going to be made available to anyone, given that Roe v. Wade was overturned just last year?
If I may say, that's a particularly perceptive question because, you know, obviously you anticipate that some of the same voices who have been sort of opposing rights to choose in terms of reproductive rights may have spoken, but not really so far. In the run-up and over many months and years in advance, you know, there were people talking about the health concerns of one pill or another. This is said by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to be very low risk due to very low levels of bleeding. I believe it's around the high 90s, 93% success rate compared with other over-the-counter medication. But some of the voices who have been opposing some of the pre-Roe v. Wade decision of the US Supreme Court last year have yet to really be too vocal on this issue.
And will any states have the opportunity to ban this pill or not?
No, because, you know, we shouldn't conflate and confuse very briefly the difference between rights to access an abortion. That's what's been limited. 14 states have all but banned that from the point of conception. And this, which is a contraceptive measure, much like others, but it's groundbreaking. This is the first time this is available to so many millions of women.
Sean Dilley in Washington there. Now, starvation, torture and exploitation, that was the treatment meted out to elderly and vulnerable people in a number of care homes across Romania, according to a new report. A high-ranking minister has now resigned after evidence emerged that organised crime networks had mistreated people in dozens of residential facilities. I asked our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe, how these gangs got the go-ahead to run care homes.
What seems to have happened is that these are state-run homes across Romania, though the focus of the investigation so far has been on something between 13 and 24 of them. So basically these were our publicly funded homes, but which were privatised. One of the journalists involved in the initial investigation called it a crazy privatisation process, where basically different companies were able to take over the homes to get major serious state funds, and then they seem to have not only pocketed the funds themselves and provided minimal, if any, food, healthcare and so on, but also in some cases they're alleged to have bribed or pushed the inmates of the homes, those being supposedly cared for, the elderly and vulnerable people, into handing over their property, even giving them access to bank accounts, things like that.
And we've heard that they were subjected to horrendous treatment. What more can you tell us about that?
These absolutely horrible starvation, torture, exploitation, people being left naked, neighbours noticing what was going on in this by basically seeing elderly people near naked or naked at the fences begging for food of some, in the very worst cases here. So absolutely horrible descriptions here, coming first from the journalists who investigated this 6 months ago, but also reports from neighbours, local people. And then, of course, the other side of this story is how slow the authorities were to react to it. And also, in some cases, allegations, as yet unproven, of a sort of cover-up of officials preventing investigations over the last 6 months after the first reports of these horrendous conditions were published.
Nick Thorpe. France is home to many luxury fashion brands, but now the government wants to encourage people to ignore the latest trends by repairing the clothes they already have instead of buying new ones. The aim is to reduce the amount of clothing sent to landfill. But the country's haute couture and fashion federation has warned that luxury garments like those made of silk should not be looked down upon just because they're less physically durable than polyester. Here's our Paris correspondent, Lucy Williamson.
The Repair Fund is the French government's antidote to fast fashion. The scheme, which is funded by contributions from commercial producers, aims to increase the volume of garments repaired by more than a third to combat pollution in the textile industry by reducing demand for new clothes. To get the discount, consumers will have to take their items to certified repairers. There have already been questions about how well the scheme will work outside major towns and cities. But the idea went down well with many of those we spoke to in central Paris today.
I think it's a good idea to avoid over-consumerism.
Upcycling is very good, but it will be more expensive than fast fashion today.
I think the people who are living here are just throwing away things that are wasted and used, and they're not trying to repair it.
Last year, France launched a similar scheme for repairing household appliances. Uptake was so slow, the government this year doubled the bonuses on offer to try and boost demand. The schemes are part of President Macron's promise to create a circular economy to reduce waste and conserve resources, designed to safeguard the future by bringing back the habits of the past.
That report from Lucy Williamson in Paris. Still to come on the Global News podcast, Japanese fishermen are up in arms over plans to release treated radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear plant into the sea.
We're already seeing the negative effects now. Some contractors have said that they won't buy Fukushima products.
The United Nations says it still hopes to see the end of HIV/AIDS by 2030. 39 million people are living with the disease worldwide, and 30 million of them are now receiving life-saving antiretroviral treatment. But the UN warns the fight to end HIV/AIDS remains underfunded and hampered in some countries. From Geneva, here's Imogen Fuchs.
HIV/AIDS still claims a life every minute. 630,000 deaths last year, 1.3 million new infections, and more than 9 million people still missing out on treatment. But the UN report shows there is a path to ending the AIDS pandemic. countries like Botswana, Rwanda and Tanzania have reached what's called the 95-95-95 target, with 95% of HIV-positive people knowing their status, receiving treatment and successfully responding to it. But those targets need money. In 2022, with many countries' economies still suffering from the COVID-19 pandemic, funding to tackle HIV/AIDS shrank. Political will is needed too. Countries which respect human rights do well in the fight against AIDS. Countries which stigmatize HIV, outlaw same-sex relations, and limit sex education do badly.
Imogen Fox. Professor Dr. Linda Gail Becker from the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation in South Africa says intolerance and restrictive laws around same-sex relations are hindering progress.
Because it's a sexually transmitted infection, it's just been steeped in stigma and discriminatory practices right from the get-go. And really, if we are going to make headway, we need the world to move forward in this regard, to accept people who live with the virus and to treat them as individuals who have a right to health and to services like anybody else. So particularly in East Africa, we've just recently seen some homosexual bills that people may have heard about, where really some laws around same-sex relationships have tightened. We know that there continue to be a lot of laws around drug use. And these are the individuals who then are driven underground and we can't reach them with the services they need for HIV care. We know that the last mile of reaching those 10 million people living with HIV for antiretrovirals is going to be the hardest, and it's going to take resources. And so this is a time when we really need the world to step forward and ensure that we can reach the end of HIV and AIDS by ensuring that everybody has access to treatment and the prevention services they need.
Professor Dr. Linda Gail Becker. Since the 2011 tsunami, which severely damaged Fukushima's nuclear plant, more than a million tons of wastewater has built up in tanks on the site. Japan has been given permission to release the radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean, a process that could begin any day now. But the plan is proving controversial, as our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil reports.
The 2011 Fukushima triple disaster crippled Japan and shocked the world. The country's most powerful earthquake triggered a tsunami that swept through the East Coast, killing more than 18,000 people and causing the world's worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl.
When you stand on a roof of one of the buildings at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, you really get to see the magnitude. I'm looking at more than a million tons of contaminated water in over 1,000 huge tanks, and they're filled with water that's been used to cool the reactors after the nuclear meltdown in Fukushima in 2011. But now these tanks are running out of space, and the government says the water has to go somewhere. Japan has been given the go-ahead to release the wastewater into the sea after it's been treated further. But this is causing a huge amount of anger and anxiety, not just here, but around the region.
TEPCO, the company running the plant, says the radioactive water will be treated, diluted, and tested for safety before it's discharged. At the advanced liquid processing system, all radioactive compounds will be removed, except one, tritium. So the water won't be completely radiation-free. But tritium, TEPCO says, will be well below international safety standards of concentration. We've now been taken into a facility inside the power plant, and it's full of fish tanks, which are closely monitored and measured for radiation. Some are filled with seawater, and others are filled with tritium-laced water. I'm standing near one of those. At the bottom, flatfish, flanders, are swimming in water that's at the same rate of radiation as that which will be pumped into the ocean, which means radioactive substances have been removed and tritium is at a safe level. The officials here tell me that it takes about 24 hours for the tritium to be flushed out of their system once the fish is back into seawater. Kazuo Yamanaka is one of the officials at the Decontamination and Decommissioning Department. He's been taking me around the plant.
I am a radiation expert, so I know that tritium has very little effect on the human body and living organisms. We are all concerned about the same thing, radiation. And that is why we are so anxious. I hope that these data and images will help to reassure people a little.
But Fukushima fishermen are not reassured. They're furious. For years, they've struggled to fight the stigma and convince people to buy their fish. Now they say the reputational damage from the water release plan will be another huge blow. An hour's drive from Hisanohama port, I sit with Toru Takahashi. His son and his grandson now run his fishing boat. This trade has been in his family for generations, and he worries about the uncertainty the water release would bring.
Before, we were able to fish across four other prefectures. Now, we're not allowed to do that. They just don't want to be associated with us. I've had so many conversations with the Japanese government and TEPCO. Nobody wants to release this dangerous water. If it's so safe, I told them, just take it to Tokyo.
The government may have all the technical approvals it needs to go ahead with their plan, but it doesn't have the support of those this plan will affect the most. The people of Fukushima will once again have to navigate their way through its troubled waters.
Shaima Khalil in Japan. The Mediterranean is a focal point for people trying to cross from Africa into Europe, and the problems associated with migration, including boat disasters, are not going to go away anytime soon. Italy is one of the major destinations for migrant crossings, and that's why Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is introducing tough new policies. The BBC's Nick Robinson is in Sicily, which is a hotspot for migrant boats.
Here in the magnificent main square of Catania in Sicily, in the Palazzo degli Elefanti, it is hard to imagine that Sicily faces any sort of migrant crisis. And yet it does. It may be one reason why this city recently elected a mayor from a party sometimes accused of being on the far right, the party of Giorgia Meloni, the relatively new Prime Minister of Italy. I've come here to speak to the mayor, Enrico Trantino, in the City Hall.
When we talk about migrants, probably there is an hypocrisy, because it's really tough to face up the situation. I will do everything I can to give better condition to people who live in a suffering way. But it's impossible to guarantee. Most of them look at Europe as like a brigadoon, that they can come here and all of them, they can have the support they need to have better life. That's why I would say it's an hypocrisy.
Some ministers in Rome have suggested that migrants are being sent to Italy by the Wagner mercenary group, by the Russians, as if this is a sort of act of war.
I heard it this morning in news. I don't know if it's true or not, but of course Wagner has the interest to have disorder somewhere in the world. And Libya is one of the parts which is involved in this kind of disorder.
The Italian government declared a state of emergency. Why was that necessary?
If they could come here, if they could find a way to integrate themselves, they could be welcome. If they come here and then they can't find a job, they just occupy the traffic light, the crossing, just to wash the windows in the car, there can't be any integration. And that's a problem because of them, because of us, it's because of everybody.
Some people have warned there could be another crisis for Italy around migration. Does it feel to you like there is a crisis coming?
I don't think the crisis is coming, but we have to pay attention at any time because it's always behind the corner, as we say in Italy. The situation in Africa, the situation in the world, the situation now in all the equilibrium between Turkish, between Russian, between China and United States, is always on progress. You never can say where the end is.
So, for you here in Sicily, Africa feels very close.
We say that all mankind are our brothers. Probably Africa and Sicily are really joined together. I only hope that we could find a way one day to give them better conditions to live their life in their country, because it's really tough to leave everything, to leave their families, to leave their roots, to leave their tradition, to try to come to a world that doesn't give anything better between they are living now.
Nick Robinson reporting from Sicily. Staff at a zoo in Canada are asking people not to show gorillas images from their mobile phones. Zookeepers believe unmoderated pictures and movies could upset the animals and affect their relationships. David Lewis reports.
Plenty of teenagers these days prefer looking at their phones to interacting with family members. But affliction might not just be a human one. Staff at Toronto Zoo are taking action after concerns were raised for Nasser, a 14-year-old Western Lowland gorilla, after visitors kept showing him pictures and videos on their devices. A spokesman for the zoo told the Toronto Star newspaper it was getting Nasser down. It was causing him to be distracted and not interacting with the other gorillas. And you know, being a gorilla, he was just so enthralled with gadgets and phones and the videos, she said. So staff have acted. A sign on the glass partition asks visitors to not show films to the animals. But it's not all bad news for the gorillas, though. The zoo deliberately uses carefully curated screen time to help them relax. Holly Ross is Toronto Zoo's animal behavioural expert.
The zookeepers that work with them there, they do show them videos of other gorillas, like wild gorillas. They show them like Planet Earth and those kind of documentaries that they really like. So other animals are really interesting to them. But we don't know exactly how they perceive that content and what it is that's catching their eyes. So we just want to make sure that the things that they're seeing are things that we think are acceptable.
While the gorillas may enjoy a peek at the occasional nature documentary, the zoo's Director of Wildlife Conservation and Welfare said the park's hyenas particularly like Disney cartoons, but she wasn't sure why.
And finally, how a Japanese children's TV show sparked a rock god collaboration between two guitar legends. Queen's Brian May and the late Eddie Van Halen teamed up for a mini album back in 1983, inspired by the kids' sci-fi series Starfleet. Now the full studio sessions are being released for the first time. Our reporter, James Alexander, has been chatting to Brian May about this unique project and its unlikely origins.
Me and my little boy Jimmy, as he was in those days, he's about 45 now. We used to get up every Saturday morning together to watch Starfleet on TV, and it was a great Japanese series, science fiction story of the Earth being invaded by aliens and Starfleet coming to fight them. It was actually puppets like Thunderbirds was. We loved it. We were all rapt waiting for the next episode to see what happened. The first thing you heard was this song, Starfleet, and it kind of got under my skin, and Jimmy loved it, and I loved it, and I was thinking, I would love to do a version of that. I could make that into a big rock anthem.
So how did the Starfleet project get off the ground? Because we're talking 1983, You're having huge success with Queen. But Queen are on hold, is that fair to say?
Yeah, Queen have not exactly split up, but we've put a distance between us for a while. We just needed a break. And I woke up on a beautiful sunny morning in Los Angeles thinking, what could I do today? I could do anything today. I could ring up my friends and we could go in the studio and have some fun. I could call Ed Van Halen because we've been friends for a while and I never call him. Why don't I call him? So I must have been feeling very brave. So I've called him up and said, do you fancy coming over to play in the studio and just knock some stuff around? He went, yeah, of course I do. Just tell me the time and place. I'll be there. I just had a ball, really. And I'm working with someone who I regard as much more adept than I am as a guitar player. He does things which I could never do. He brought to it this amazing ability to treat his guitar keyboard as if it was a piano keyboard. He made the guitar a new instrument.
One, two, three.
The thing about this album, which I'm putting out now, the repackaging and the reworking of Starfleet is you hear every note we play, and every time the tape rolled, you hear it. So you hear us making all the mistakes, having a laugh, trying something else, trying somebody else's ribs or whatever, and gradually coming together to make what became the record.
Just finally, we began by talking about your son and how much he loved the Starfleet TV show and how that inspired this whole project. I got to ask, what did he make of the finished record?
He loved it. Yeah, he was very, very happy. I think he still is, and I think he's happy that he was a part of the creation of that. He's proud of his dad, I think, on the whole.
Great stuff. Brian May speaking to James Alexander. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lee Wilson and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Wendy Urquhart. Until next time, take care.